The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kwiatkowski, and this week we're demystifying the process of starting your own web business. What does Series A, Angel, and Seed actually mean? The Equity Kicker's Nick Brisbourne, partner at venture capitalist firm DFJ Esprit, is in the studio to talk me through the process, and he gives his expert opinion on what and where the next big things are. Speaking of big things, Charles Arthur speaks with Patrick Spence, MD of Global Sales and Regional Marketing at Research in Motion, the makers of leading mobile manufacturer BlackBerry. What of their meteoric rise and recent fall? And how do they plan to reassert their position as a big fish in the global pond? These stories, plus the latest news over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. RIM's BlackBerry was once a global smartphone superpower, but recently its share in its largest markets, in particular the US, has dropped dramatically. Charles Arthur spoke with Patrick Spence, MD of Global Sales and Regional Marketing, about the company's next steps to regain their place in the smartphone race, from the new handsets, operating systems, and their tablet, the Playbook. And as we mentioned on this program a few weeks ago, RIM plans to cut 2,000 jobs. So what is the future for the company whose messenger service allegedly played a key role in organizing the London street riots? Charles began by asking him what is going on at RIM.
Well, from where I sit, I think it's a story of great growth internationally. So we reported, 67% year-over-year growth in our international markets, which I think is a testament to the growing popularity of BlackBerry globally. And just yesterday, Canalys announced their results for calendar Q2, and we actually became the number one smartphone provider in Africa, overtaking Nokia. And we also are the number two smartphone provider in the Middle East, very close to Nokia. We've closed the gap there. And in Western Europe, we continue to be strong. So I think, as I look at it, I think it's a story of the entire globe really picking up on the benefits of BlackBerry, both for business users and consumers at the same time. And you mentioned the U.S., and I think that's a market where, we do have some challenges. It's a very different market. It's unique to many of the other markets, but I think the international growth has been phenomenal.
Why is it so different in the U.S. than Europe?
So in the United States, for instance, they've had flat rate data pricing for a long time, which has meant that users haven't really been too concerned about how they're using their smartphones. And so that's something that is unique when you start to look at other markets around the globe. The other thing is they've changed the highways. So they've gone to 4G as well due to some of these data consumption habits of many of the users. And so, that's unique to that market. And so it's been a change in the types of devices that are used there. And you've recently seen them change as well in the United States to usage-based pricing. So I think you'll start to see a change in behavior as well with customers there. But outside the United States, it's different in terms of where we are today. So you see the 2G and 3G networks, obviously. Here in the UK, great example of the fact where 4G is still a ways away, right? We haven't even had the spectrum auctions yet. So it's very different. And I think it's dangerous. There's sometimes assumptions made, that whatever's going to happen in the United States is going to happen around the world. And I think that's a dangerous extrapolation unless you really dig into why.
But I mean, it's not as if Apple has a 4G phone. They've only got a 3G phone. Pretty much all of the phones that are being sold are 3G phones. And in the US, my understanding is that they're moving to capped data. So you're talking about 500 megabytes per month, but that's the same as in the UK. It's not usage-based. It's simply capped. And pretty much everyone comes in under the ceiling of 500 megabytes per month.
So what we've seen with most is typically a 200 meg plan and then a 2 gig plan in the US for the most part. And so, I think we're just at the beginning of that transition, if you will, in the United States. And so what we're going to see is how people adopt that, right? And what it does to change the behavior. It hasn't been out long enough to have changed anyone's behavior at this particular point in time. So we'll see what the impact of that is.
So talking of transition, you mentioned that. BlackBerry is being, in effect, moved off. The old BlackBerry 6 OS is being killed off. You're moving to BlackBerry 7. And then you're also going to move after that to QNX, as I understand it, on the smartphone platform. How does that work? How can you do not just one platform shift, but two, in succession. Why? I mean, first of all, why do it? And secondly, how can you expect it to succeed?
So we, you know, get pretty hung up on operating systems and the value of operating systems and which one, who's using which operating system and the like of it. But at the end of the day, it's about the customer experience. And so, you know, the reason we're doing BlackBerry 7 is to bring, you know, the 67 million BlackBerry users worldwide a better experience and to get more users on board, right? And so we've really focused on, you know, browsing as well, you know, in terms of making sure the browsing is much improved, you know, and so it's 40% faster than our existing browsing today. And we've got the best in class HTML5 and JavaScript rendering with BlackBerry 7 on our browser. So we've, you know, upped the game in that area.
So if it's so great, why abandon it later than for QNX?
Well, we're definitely not abandoning it. It'll run in parallel with the QNX. So QNX, as you look at it and you look at the transition, is a super powerful platform that really sets up the next generation, right? And so you've seen it on Playbook. You kind of see the promise of it on Playbook. And what we're doing is going to move that to, you know, the Superphone platform over time. And yes, you know, as dual-core processors and quad-core processors become less expensive, you'll see that move through the line. But certainly, you know, BlackBerry 7 and the experience around BlackBerry, the value of BBM, you know, the email that we have, the security, all of that is consistent, you know. And so we're really making sure that BlackBerry as a proposition continues and its value proposition is quite similar, you know, regardless of OS.
Surely the difficulty about platform shifts isn't that one is faster than another, because a lot of people would be happy with that. It's that you're trying to bring along an app ecosystem, and that's very hard to do. I mean, that's what Nokia is struggling with at the moment, is trying to keep the Symbian developers happy when they know that, in effect, they have a death sentence. And the Playbooks mixed results have come as much as anything, because the App Store experience there is really not very satisfactory at all. There are so few QNX apps out there that it's just simply not, you know, all you have is basically a browsing device. So the question, you know, reposes itself of why move to first to BlackBerry 7? So one assumes there has to be some sort of app upgrade, and then to QNX, in which case you must have yet another one.
It'll be a fairly easy transition to go from BlackBerry 6 application to BlackBerry 7. And you can, you know, as you can imagine, we're working to make it easier and easier for these developers to make sure that they can move those applications, you know, into the future on QNX as well. And we have to support the community better. We're working on that. You know, we're trying to engage more constructively globally, I would say, in terms of how we're doing that, make sure we have local support. And you'll see that in some of the applications that come out. And at the end of the day, you know, it's making the tools better, and we're working on that. And it's making sure we have the support systems in place to be able to do it. But it's something that we're very, very focused in on.
But
we're
still not understanding why you're doing it twice rather than doing it once.
We're doing it twice because we want to give customers the very best experience on BlackBerry.
And but surely it's not going to be the very best experience, because they'll say, okay, so now I'm on BlackBerry 7, and there might be some sort of, you know, some things. It's never completely smooth, even when you do an upgrade. You know, when Apple does an upgrade from one iOS version to another, there's some apps have to be rewritten. But you're doing this to them twice.
But it's our job to make that transition as seamless as possible, and that is what we're focused on doing as we do it. So there's things that we wanted to deliver to customers that would only be possible through BlackBerry 7, which again is an extension of, you know, the heritage of BlackBerry and the platform we've built over the last 10 years. So it's not like we've created a brand new platform from scratch and done it again with QNX, right? We're talking about one platform which we're enhancing, and then another new platform which really sets us up for the next 10 years.
So if BlackBerry 7 would be so great for the users, then why not have put that on the Playbook?
Well, the Playbook, and as we get into an even more powerful computing platform, right, with dual-core processors, and we really look at, you know, mobile computing as opposed to, you know, smartphones and some of the things that have happened in the past, we saw an opportunity to really get a platform for the future and allow us to leapfrog what's happening, you know, in the marketplace. So you see it. You mentioned the browsing on Playbook. I mean, it's an industry-leading browsing experience today.
I disagree, but I still don't understand why you went for QNX there if you have BlackBerry 7 available.
Because when you look at what's happening in the mobile computing space holistically, and you look at the smartphones, you look at the tablets, and you look what will be possible in the future, we feel that QNX, with, you know, its ability to run you know, today in different medical environments, government environments, military environments, is such a powerful operating system that it'll give us more opportunity to deliver even better experiences to the customer. As we get into 4G networks, as we get into, you know, the future applications that are out there, we want something that's even more powerful for what's going to happen over the next decade.
Okay. One other thing I'd like to bring up, which is a survey that was done by CounterContact, which was looking at how smartphone owners use their devices. And it does it country by country. It looks at things like how, do they do things like downloading, listening to music, playing games, internet navigation, and so on. And it looks at it for the total market. It looks at it for the average of smartphones, for Apple's iPhone, for Android phones, and then for RIM BlackBerrys. And in pretty much every one of these, the BlackBerry sort of underperforms. It under-indexes against the iPhone and against Android phones. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think if you look at it, and I'm just looking at it for the first time here, but if you look at, for instance, using instant messaging, I think it is, for instance, we're in the lead. And here, Charles, our heritage is what I would say is the ultimate communications experience. So you saw it in the early days in terms of what we did with email. And we changed email. We really shifted email and changed the way people used email. And it became instant communications in a way. We took those same pillars and delivered that kind of experience with BlackBerry Messenger, the way we integrate with Facebook and Twitter today. And we've really created a great communications experience, which continues to resonate with business customers, and now even more so with consumers. You see teenagers in Manchester and London using the product, in Spain and South Africa. It's absolutely incredible. We've been, very focused on those areas and making sure we deliver that ultimate communications experience. You know, while we've done that, we've begun to enhance the other parts of the platform. So, multimedia, right, where some of our competitors had a natural advantage based on what they had done before. Browsing, for instance, right, our acquisition of Torch and now the work that we've done on BB6 and on BB7. And there's other areas of the experience that no doubt we need to improve on. And we are. We're working on that and making sure we do that. But I think, again, we've been successful through this ultimate communications experience. And now it's a case of extending that to other things. But I think it's dangerous as well to try and be all things to all people. We're very focused in terms of what we try to do.
Patrick Spence with Charles Arthur. Now, for more on how BlackBerry are responding to the London riots, here's Jemima with this and the rest of the week's news.
BlackBerry maker Research in Motion has refused to expand on a statement yesterday that said it will help police investigate organisers behind the London riots, prompting concerns the provider might share private messages with the Met Police. BlackBerry's instant messenger was widely used during riots across London, while the family of Mark Duggan, who was shot dead by police last week, has moved to distance itself from the disturbances. A slew of lawsuits in the US is targeting BitTorrent users over copyright infringement, with more than 200,000 people being sued for allegedly sharing copyrighted material online. A report by Torrent Freak claimed mass lawsuits are generating significant revenues for rights holders if every case settles with an agreed fee of $2,500, $250 million would be generated out of piracy. 4 weeks into its attempt to conquer the US, music streaming service Spotify has signed up 1.4 million users, one source told All Things Digital, with 175,000 of those opting for the paid version of the service. Spotify still has its work cut out, competing with more established rivals in the US market, including Rhapsody, which has 800,000 paid subscribers.
Thanks, Jemima. Read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Venture capitalist Nick Brisbourne has been supporting new digital startups since 2000, helping to fund entrepreneurial dreams into financial realities. It's a dark science. Nick has most recently invested in travel social network Wayne and the social media service Conversocial, and he writes popular investment blog The Equity Kicker. We invited him into the Tech Weekly studio to talk us through what he does, how the funding process works, and what the global economic meltdown means for the futures of some of the most popular web services, from Facebook to Twitter to Groupon to Zynga to LinkedIn, and where the big money is next. I began by asking him how he got into the VC scene in the first place.
Well, it was the late 90s. I was working in a startup in the city of London. And, all around me, the world was going crazy, right? Exciting times, really exciting times. And, unfortunately, the startup I was in was cool in lots of ways. They're still going. But, I figured it kind of wasn't quite going to hit the heights that I was after. So I started looking around for where I would go next. And venture capital just looked terribly exciting as a way to have multiple startups. I'd previously been a consultant. And I figured that the skill set I picked up there, coupled with my experience at a startup, put those two things together, was a very good fit with what a VC needs. And so I started networking around trying to find a job. And, you know, it took me a year. It's not an easy industry to get into, even in those boom times. But that's how it all started.
My vision of a VC is that he or she is an independently wealthy philanthropist. You know, I'm thinking David Copperfield or Great Expectations, I suppose, is more like it. Mrs. Habersham. I suppose that's more of a philanthropist. Situate me in the reality of what it is that VCs do.
So there are people like that. There are independently wealthy individuals who make investments in startups, and, you know, they do it partly in the hope of changing the world for the good, you know, and, you know, we all want to do a bit of that, but they also want to make some money typically. So there are those groups of people, and, you know, I guess you'll have heard talk of business angels, and, you know, a lot of business angels are as you describe. But venture capital is a more institutional business, and so business angels are typically individuals. Venture capitalists operate in partnerships, typically sort of 4 to 9. We've got 9 partners in DFJ Esprit. And we're not investing our own money. We're investing money from our investors. So, you know, just as startups have to raise money from us, we have to go and raise money from the investors in our funds. We call them limited partners, and they're typically pension funds, insurance companies, forward-thinking corporations, and governments.
So I've got a brilliant idea, right? I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I've got a brilliant idea, and I want to be an entrepreneur. Right? I want to create this amazing digital company. What's the process? Would I go to you first, or would I go to an angel?
The sequence is, you know, get started, try and do something as much as you can on your own, and
this is the bootstrapping,
yeah,
bit, isn't
bootstrapping
it? This is
period.
Like where you dig behind the sofa and you get all the loose change that you can support yourself with beans on toast.
Or, you know, or you're working on your startup idea at evenings and weekends. You still got your day job. That's what's paying the rent. For example, Wayne, where are you now? A travel-focused social network in which we invested. The two founders there were at Accenture. They had this idea of this travel social network. This was back in 2005. And they carried on working at Accenture. They started building it up in the background. So they didn't really need any money. I think they raised £25,000. That kind of got them started and enabled them to get the servers live. But, you know, they were paying the rent by using their salaries from Accenture. And then when things got to a certain level, they ditched their jobs at Accenture and went full-time at Wayne, and then things started to really take off after that.
And then they would come to you at that point when they've ditched their jobs and they say, right, actually, we think that this has legs.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we've ever funded a startup where the founders are still working at their previous jobs. You know, sometimes people come to us often, you know, and we welcome it. I've got a really interesting idea. This is what I'm thinking of doing. Would you fund it? And if we do think it's a great idea, then we'll say, yeah, sure. But, you know, you need to leave your job, get started, and then come talk to us later.
What kind of money are we talking? You say that they, and this is just this particular network, this particular idea, they raised $25,000. I'm assuming this would be part of the angel round, as it's called. And then they would come. Are there particular financial monetary levels at which point it becomes realistic to talk to a VC? When you're talking to a VC, what are the different rounds, levels? You know, what are the money figures that we're talking about at the different stages?
Yeah, so it varies a lot, but to try and put some structure on it for you, if you think of angel investments as being anywhere from £50,000 maybe up to £500,000, you know, and often the first round will, you know, more than one angel round, so the first might be £50,000 or £25,000, and then subsequent rounds rising. And then you get into venture capital territory, typically around £1 million, £1.5 million, £2 million, and that will be, so the first venture capital round will typically be of that sort of size. So the last investment that I made was a company called Conversocial, and we invested £1.5 million in that. You know, and then we call that the Series A. And then we're anticipating a subsequent round at Conversocial maybe in 12, 18 months' time, which will probably be more like £5 million, something like that.
You guys are reliant upon other investments and fundraising from other sources. The things that you mentioned are things like pensions, or I can imagine that there's a lot of volatility, particularly right now, given the global economic, shall we say, meltdown. What's happening? Yeah, in the US. How does this, you know, what's happening with your business? What's happening with the types of things that you're looking for, and generally for, you know, the companies that you've invested in? What effect is this having on the VC scene?
So in summary, it's not going to be great, I don't think. but venture capital moves to a much, much slower heartbeat than the public stock markets. You know, NASDAQ falls 6% in a day yesterday. You know, venture capital investments, venture capital funds operate over 7 to 10 year periods. And so, you know, things move slowly. So, you know, we closed our new fund last year, and we'll probably go out and raise our next fund in maybe 2 years' time, 2013. And so you need to look at short-term events and try and figure out how, you know, the impact they're going to have over the longer term. And so, you know, for us, it's really all about how things are looking in 2012, 2013. That's going to determine, you know, how big we can get our next fund to be.
And how is the tech scene looking? And actually, are you just looking at the tech scene? Or are you looking, for example, at the amount of rainfall that's happening in a particular country, which is potentially going to have an effect on the number of bananas that are grown, which is potentially going to have an effect? You know, you can kind of deconstruct how much you look at and how you use different predictive models. So are you specifically looking at tech trends and, you know, bears and bulls and, you know, all that kind of thing?
Charty stuff.
Yeah, all the charty things. I remember this from my civics classes. Yeah.
So we don't do all that complicated hedge fund stuff really at all. We try and take a strong view on markets and technologies that are evolving. And, you know, and these big technology trends typically play out over kind of 4 or 5 years, and there'll be a number of big companies created that are associated with those trends, and, you know, and then you try and find the sub trends to go with it. So,
Can you give me an example?
Sure. So social networking has been a good one over the last 5 years. Obviously, there was, you know, first French Reunited was very early and the big success, first big success in the UK. Then we had Bebo, MySpace, and Facebook. And so, you know, a number of successful companies leveraging that social trend. And now the next interesting thing coming off the back of that is, and this is where Conversocial fits, is enterprises, big companies figuring out, you know, how do we use Facebook? How do we use social networks to go better about our own business? So in the case of Conversocial, it's all about helping companies like Groupon is one of their biggest customers to use Facebook to better serve their customers. So, you know, customer service on social media.
Speaking of Groupon and also some of the other people that you've mentioned, Facebook, they are all likely to float quite soon. They're likely to, you know, either
IPOs. Chances
of
that are kind of receding, aren't they, at the moment,
well,
right?
Yeah. And obviously there are the trends that we can see that are going tech. But are these big players floating an indication that 4 to 5 year cycle is over and that you should then start looking towards the next thing? That, okay, right now they're the big wigs. We need to start looking at tech or, you know, social trends that are going to be the next things that we invest in.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So social networks as a trend is definitely coming towards it's through the phase when it's an interesting place to make new venture capital investments, definitely. You know, it's coming to the stage where the biggest and most successful ones are having their IPOs. You know, and those companies have still got a lot of growth to go, but, you know, we're all in the venture capital industry all about investing in startups that are making these things happen right at the beginning, not kind of 4 or 5 years down the line, right? So the interesting thing now from a social media point of view, or as I was just saying, is, you know, how do companies like Groupon or Tesco's or Sainsbury's, you know, how do they leverage social media to better go about their business? And you can sell them software to help them do that better. Other very interesting trends, obviously mobile at the moment, you know, everybody's getting smartphones now and the price is dropping and data connections and networks are improving. And, you know, that's springing up all sorts of new services and new potential, and it's really hard to call actually how all that's going to play out right now. You know, there have been a few things that have frothed up really exciting, you know, Foursquare and the whole check-in idea, and, you know, and that's really powerful, but I think it's too early to know whether that's the end game in this space or not. You know, and then there's a whole voucher thing going on, and so, you know, that's a very interesting place at the moment.
So what we've got right now in terms of the global economic climate is we've got, you know, the demotion of the US as a AAA creditor. Mm-hmm. How does their demotion affect your specific business?
We invest all around Europe, so we're about half in the UK and half around the rest of Europe. And we do the occasional deal in the US. So we've done one deal, a company called Radium One, out of 6 in the new fund so far, one is in the US. But we're very linked to the US in the sense that the companies in which we invest are all about going global from day one. And so the US is an important market. And so if the US market goes belly up, then it's much harder for our companies here to be successful. And so it's very important how things happen over there. And I guess that's the biggest impact.
also there are other countries that are starting to bubble up. I don't know if you happen to have interest in Chinese companies. I know that certainly a trend is for VCs to start looking towards China and invest in Chinese companies. I mean, that's interesting socially because obviously if you're investing, then potentially you've got some kind of leverage over the direction that they take their technologies and their systems. So are you looking to invest in China? Are there other regions, you know, for example, in the Middle East, are you looking?
The question of how you address global markets is a really interesting one for venture capitalists because it's a very local business being a VC. And so the way that we've chosen to address the global opportunity at DFJ Esprit is to become part of a global network of funds. So we have partner funds, in China. We don't have one in Indonesia yet. We have one in Vietnam. We now have one in Japan, Russia, Israel, Brazil. And so we're seeking to grow that network quite aggressively and a few funds in the States as well.
And are there any specific areas that you see as exploding? Because certainly, you know, maybe about 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was Eastern Europe where everybody was suddenly jumping over there. Are there other regions around the world that people should be looking out for? The next big social network or the next big facilitator will come out of, everybody's thinking China, but will come out of Vietnam or will come out of the Philippines?
So I'm not seeing any areas, any countries other than China, really, that are creating these huge businesses and big profits for entrepreneurs and VCs. So that's, I guess, the one place I'd point to. Maybe India coming a little bit. We're doing more and more in India.
And what is the greatest stumbling block? What do you see time and time again when people, that's the hurdle that people fall over the fastest?
First, pick one thing, and it's kind of tough, but if I was to pick one thing, I would say focusing on building a great product rather than getting out as quickly as you can and talking to customers and working with them to iterate your product to build something that the market really wants. I said, interestingly, if you'd have asked me 5 years ago, I'd have said that was quite a British thing. We used to talk about the Cambridge phenomena, right? These were these clever technology, deep technology companies in Cambridge, raise money, build a fantastic product, stick their head above the parapet and go, oh, do you want to buy my shiny thing? And everyone would go, yeah, it's kind of shiny, but I don't need one of them, right? And, we would talk about that as something which happened too often to startups in Cambridge. But one of the interesting things that's happened in the startup world over the last couple of years is this lean startup movement. Have you heard of that? And so propounded by two guys in the US, Steve Blank and Eric Ries, really trying to put some science into the process of building a company and, so people can follow a process and be less prone to making mistakes and less subjected to chance, which is great, right? It increases your predictability of success. But the thing that they're focused on is exactly the same problem that these Cambridge companies had, which is, not talking to your customers early enough. That is the big insight that those guys have brought. And so I think it's a global thing. The beauty of the web, of course, is that you can get products out there really quickly and you can get people, you can spend some money on AdWords, you can get some people onto your site really quickly. These things don't need to take any time at all these days.
Is there any particular aspect of the UK regulation scene or any particular aspect of the development scene in general in the UK that inspires you, that makes you feel, yes, this is a really, really exciting space to be in right now?
Entrepreneurs have come together and, they're forming their own networks and, they're all very good friends with each other. They're out drinking together and, and that's kind of creating this palpable sense of excitement and real feeling of opportunity and, and when you look at Silicon Roundabout, right, they're all moving to Shoreditch now, these guys, and when they talk about it, right, you can see the excitement on their faces. You can hear it in their voices and That reminds me of what I saw in the Valley when I was working out there 10 years ago. That, and that kind of passion and belief and excitement is really sort of coming on strong now in the UK. And also in Berlin, I think, is very good too. So I'd pick on that.
10 years ago, though, we were in the middle of a bubble, which subsequently burst. So what are we in the middle of a new bubble?
Yeah, are we in the middle of a new bubble? The success of the tech sector has been on a different trajectory to the success of the overall economy for the last year or so, right? And that can't go on forever. So, you know, the two things will come back together. Whether it's going to feel like a bubble crashing, you know, NASDAQ dropping 60% in a couple of weeks or whatever happened in March 2000, that I'm not quite so sure about because I don't think it's so widely spread. You know, maybe the IPOs won't come around quite so quickly for Groupon and Facebook and Zynga. Maybe there won't be quite such high prices. You know, maybe some of the companies that have gone public recently will kind of trend flat or maybe even down a little bit. But I don't think there's going to be this almighty crash, you know, that there was before. I hope not, anyway.
Nick Brisbourne, partner at DFJ Esprit. Find out more at theequitykicker.com. That's all for this week's podcast. Thank you very much to our guests. Next week, the team is back and there will be more analysis and commentary from Charles and Jemima. You can see all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The producer was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.